Welcome home. We are WNST, AM 1570, Taos in Baltimore. We are Baltimore Positive and Positively. This is going to be my favorite segment of the summer. I'm predicting this now. Even though I've had some rock stars on, there's still some opportunities to maybe improve. I don't know. Maybe George Brett will come on. I can't bring Tony Gwynn back, but Sisto Lescano's already been on the show. But this one's going to be fun. You all know I'm doing the Maryland Crab Cake Tour all summer long. It's all brought to you by the Maryland Lottery. I'll have the Back to the Future scratch-offs. We're going to be at Di Pasquale's on the 8th. I got some great guests coming that day. Dan Rodericks, Pete Carinci, some of my favorite people. First time there, and we're also going to be at Costas in Timonium on the 10th at the new racetrack location. Come on out, get out of the heat, get into the cold, watch some baseball, and maybe we'll reminisce. Maybe if you hear this piece and you come out and see me, we'll talk about Fred Lynn. And I think of you as a Red Sox. You got your Red Sox hat on, but man, you came to us in '85. Man, I was 16 years old. You're one of my favorite players, and next thing I know, you're out at Memorial Stadium. So, having you on's a big deal, even for a guy been doing this 35 years. So, my wife says I don't get starstruck too much. Only Paul Rogers from Bad Company starstruck me, other than you, Fred Lynn. So, welcome aboard. Thanks for making time for me, man.
Well, thanks for having me on the show. I appreciate it.
Well, you wonder why is the guy from Baltimore having you on? So I ran into you in Houston at the Super Bowl in like 2004, and I shook your hand, and you said, "I'll come on anytime." So it's taken me 21 years to track you down, but you have been tip of the tongue in a couple of ways. First off, I'm on this crazy device, and I think your Aqua Velva commercial popped up about
Oh
a
my
year and
God.
a half ago. And my wife grew up in Manchester, New Hampshire, and when I said Fred Lynn to her, she knew who you were. I mean, as though she's a Red Sox fan, right? So I saw the Aqua Velva thing, but then I had John Eisenberg on about 6 weeks ago, and he mentioned he had had you on for his bird tapes, and I thought, man, I felt jealous when he's getting guests I can't get. So I feel like, John, I'm getting even. I got Fred Lynn. This is awesome. But Jim Henneman passed away a couple weeks ago, and it just brought so many people together to talk about baseball. Tim Kurkjian and Jim Palmer, just a whole bunch of people. And now the Orioles are in last place, and we were coming to Anaheim, and I had Doug DeSensei on. And I thought about you, and I tried to find you, and here we are on the internet. And I'm just blessed that you take a little time and talk some Baltimore memories. But Rick Vaughn gave me the greatest story about you, and I don't remember this, but he swears you will. He said, Fred Lynn came, and Fred Lynn was a big deal for me, and I got to pick him up at the airport, and I was calling my friends and telling them I'm picking Fred Lynn up. Then you came in, and in the first month, you hit walk-off home runs in 85 on a weekend in May in front of a sellout crowd, and Rick Vaughn said, tell Fred Lynn I never heard Memorial Stadium ever louder than it was that night. Ask him if he remembers hitting walk-offs in 85.
You know what? That's a pretty unique situation. They talk about walk-offs now. That term wasn't invented yet when I did it,
It
but it
was a
was the fun.
game-winning homer.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. Game-winning hit, right? So we're playing the Twins, and I was always a Twin killer, no matter what team I played for. And it's the bottom of the ninth, and they bring in Ron Davis, their closer, and we got a guy on. We're down by a run, and I hit a slider over the fence for a home run. This is Friday night. And the place was going crazy. We always drew well, but Friday and Saturdays were our best draw nights. So I hit the game winner that night. Now, the next night, we're in the same situation, but we're down by two, and Eddie and Cal are on first and third. We got one out. So now I'm not going to bring in Ron Davis to face me again. So they bring in this left-hander. I didn't even know who he was. I was watching him warm up, and I said to myself, okay, he's going to try to pitch me away because I just hit one to right the night before. So he threw a fastball away, and I crushed it to left center for another walk-off. So we won that game, and that place was absolutely rocking, and it was so electric. So now we play day game, right? Next day on Sunday, Frankie Viola's pitching for those guys. Now he's shutting us out. It's like 7-0 going into the bottom of the ninth. I come up with two guys on, and I hit one out to dead center. Now, it wasn't a game winner, but it broke up the shutout. And that's three consecutive nights or at games that I hit a home run in the bottom of the ninth.
He remember that. He swore you'd remember it too. It's only been 40 years. I don't want to go back too far, in all of this. Fred Lynn is our guest. I'm blessed to have him on, talking a little bit of baseball. Do you watch a lot of ball? I mean, I know you sort of reside in San Diego, Southern California area. When I'm in that area, in modern times. It feels very baseball juggernaut-y. I mean, what Tony Gwynn left behind, the new stadium in Petco. When I'm out there, obviously Ohtani and Trout and all that, and your former organization, as well as just what the Dodgers are. I don't want to say it never felt like a hotbed. You played your college ball at USC, all that. You've been out there forever, went back out there after Boston. But I remember going out there at various points when they were playing at Jack Murphy, and it was friends and family at various points. The Angels had problems at various points, but it feels like it's just, and especially for Hispanic people, my name's Aparicio. It is especially a hotbed as you've gotten older in life. Baseball's picked up momentum where you live, right?
Absolutely. When Larry Lucchino was the juggernaut behind the San Diego Padres and helped to get the new stadium built downtown, that's when things really changed. Because you mentioned Jack Murphy, that's a football stadium that they play baseball in. It wasn't a great place to play baseball, to be honest with you. I played there. But this stadium downtown is very unique. Kind of has vibes of Wrigley to it because there's a warehouse building part of left field. And it's very intimate. And they pack it every night. And so baseball is fun to go to because it's right downtown and they're good. They have a good team. And that's been the case for quite a few years now. And obviously, the relationship with the LA Dodgers helps, so they're just up the street. And so it's kind of like Red Sox Yankees, now it's Dodgers Padres, and there's a real rivalry there. And it's pretty prevalent here because we don't have a football team, there's no basketball team here. It's baseball and surfing. So during the summertime, they pack them in.
Do you love that you have this legacy in different places? You live in San Diego, but you're really an Angel, but you're really a Red Sox, and today you're an Oriole. I mean, a lot of people don't even remember the Oriole part. I couldn't even win a lot when you were here, but I certainly remember the years you came, and you and Don Ossie, and that period of time, Eddie and Cal, and the post-'83 thing, and you found a real hot place in Baltimore, and a place that I think the time you were here, there was some we lost the Colts. There was a question about like whether the Orioles might be going to DC. They had DC ownership. I mean, the Orioles were really resurrected in that period of time, I think, by Cal Ripken and by the departure of the Colts. But it was kind of a unique time to be in Baltimore for the couple of years you were here as well. Earl coming back, you were a part of all that too, yeah.
Yes, I was. And it was the Orioles were kind of in transition. Listen, I was a free agent and I had the opportunity to go somewhere. And the Orioles were always a pain in our side when I was with the Red Sox because they had such good pitching and they had timely hitting. And I said, I'm going to go to a place where pitching is forefront. And because everywhere I played prior to that, we hit our way to championships if we got there. We hit our way there. We didn't pitch our way there. So I'm going to Baltimore. And they need a center fielder, and I thought it would be a perfect fit. Well, the pitching just kind of was in transition as well. So we didn't pitch as well as I'd hoped, but I got to give props to the Baltimore fan base because they supported us no matter what. Now we had some star power with Eddie and Cal, and we had some pretty good players on our team, and we were fun to watch. We didn't win a lot. But we were fun to watch, and the fans showed up, and I really, really enjoyed playing there. I enjoyed the atmosphere, I enjoyed the fan base, I enjoyed my teammates. The only thing missing was winning, and I thought that would happen, and it didn't work out that way. But my time in Baltimore is very special to me.
I didn't even realize this till 30 seconds ago. I mean, I'm a pretty good Oriole historian. I've been at this a long time. I was born into it as an Aparicio in East Baltimore in 68. But you were here for the 0-21. I wouldn't have guessed that. And I'm looking at the wiki, and I know I was at Fantastic Fans Night, right? When y'all came back after the game out in Chicago. Talk about that period of time for the kids out there, because and we're talking now 37 years ago, that we're in last place here in Baltimore, Fred, and we're not supposed to be, and it's
That's
really
right.
disappointing, so much so that I'm finding my baseball heroes to chat with them and talk about their golf charities and all that kind of stuff as well. For that period, I've lived through all of this, and I sense, even in the broadcast, Jim Palmer's disappointment of 42 years of not winning, and Camden Yards not being a place where we've really won. It's been a little bit of, not a little bit, a lot of a downer here. And the 88 thing, being a part of that and you being a player, and I sat in left field that night. I sat in left field a lot at Memorial Stadium with my pop back in 88. We all went out there that night to give you love, and I don't think that's like postcards. That's Hallmark stuff. Like, you know, like if I tell somebody that happened, they'd be like, oh, but that can't happen in America in 2025. I mean, who would come out and support that, right? I mean, and when you tell people the story, it's a unique story in the history of baseball, maybe in the history of sports, if it were told in the way that it really happened, and maybe through your eyes, to come home and see the ballpark packed. I mean, I don't even know if you knew to even expect that at that point, right?
Well, probably not, to be honest with you. It was a very, very taxing, demoralizing, whatever kind of adjective you want to say, experience for the players. Not only players, our families, the fan base. I mean, everybody was just like, when are they going to win a game? And we kept inventing ways to lose games. Sometimes it was comical, although not from the player's perspective. I remember we were in Minnesota. We had nine guys starting. We drew names out of a hat for the hitting order, right? And so I
Frank's
remember I
idea
played.
by now, right?
Yeah, I mean, I led off, and it was against Frankie Varela, and I led off the game with a home run and said, all right, we're in there. Nah, we lost. And so after Eddie, I think, drove in like nine runs in a game in Chicago, if we finally won a game. And then we come home, and the place looked like we won the World Series. It was really heartwarming for us as players because, you know, we felt like we just let Baltimore down and the our fan base, but they said, nope, we're still here. And they really supported us all summer. And I'm sure we were tough to watch. Was it for lack of trying, but it's the fan base never gave up on us. And, you know, so props to them. And talk about this year's team. You know, I thought they were top dog in the league, to be honest, after the last couple of years. I said, well, these guys are younger. They've been together now. You know, that this is going to be their year. You know, and it started off kind of wanky, but it's still not over because the division, in my estimation, is up for grabs. There's weaknesses in every team there. Tampa's kind of come out of nowhere for me, but the Orioles still are not out of it. I'm telling you. They could get hot. It's not that difficult to go 25-5 in a month. It's not. I've seen it done. So you do that, start spinning some games your way and get some momentum because the rest of the division is just not that good. You know, they're all around 500. The Yankees have some issues. And Tampa's a team I just can't figure out. But the Orioles, you know, keep your heads up. You know, you're still not out of it.
Well, I don't need to tell you. You already told me. You got to get pitching. I mean, if you're going to be an excellent team, you have to have really good pitching. Mediocre pitching and banging hitting, that doesn't really win championships in our lifetime, I don't think.
No, it certainly doesn't. You look at teams that win consistently, and here's a team I'll say, Detroit. They've won 50 games faster than anybody else right now. I didn't see those guys, but pitching is, you know, what they do well, and they're getting some timely hitting. But pitching is the name of the game, and that was for years and years and years. That's the Baltimore way. You know, pitch well, score runs into the bottom of the eighth, and win the game. That's how they did it. And so if you don't have arms, especially in a place like Camden, where it's a smaller ballpark, plays small sometimes, you know, maybe the pitching philosophy has to change. Instead of power, let's throw strikes, keep the ball down in the zone, keep the ball in the park, and play that way. You know, the pendulum has swung so much on the other side for power, we forgot how to throw strikes, quality strikes. Let's take more guys like Greg Maddux. Even Jim Palmer threw strikes. You know what, guys? So, and that whole Baltimore staff back in the day. Let's maybe start doing that. And there has to be one organization that's going to say, all right, we're done with throwing 100 miles an hour. That's not working for us. Let's get guys that throw strikes, don't walk anybody, can go 7 or 8 innings, maybe nine. Imagine that. And start going back the other way. It's going to take somebody to do it. Might as well be Baltimore.
If you are watching out on the webcam, he's got a hat with a B on it, and he knows better than to think that that's Baltimore. But he's wearing a Boston Red Sox hat. Fred Lynn is here. You're my favorite player in 1975, so I'll give you my story. Louis came to Baltimore in '63 and brought two cousins from Venezuela. I am the son of one of the cousins. I'm the only one that's left behind. And in 1973, I was 5 years old, and Louis was playing for the Red Sox. And I went at Memorial Stadium. I got my little picture. I have the ball that was signed by Tiant, Fisk, Yastrzemski, go down the line, Cepeda, just that was a 73. You were sort of Pawtucketing at that point and kind of USCing and making your way through. Did you and Louie ever walk on the same field together, playing a spring training game together? I'm trying to piece that together because Beníquez came, Burleson came, and then Rice and Lynn was one word in 75, right? Like you guys together. But it all happened in the blink of an eye to a little boy who had a Red Sox bobblehead because my cousin was heading to the Hall of Fame and played for the Red Sox in 1973, and I was at Memorial Stadium. Now, I love the Orioles and like all of that, but my uncle was a five and wearing a Red Sox jersey. A minute and a half later, you and Rice are in first place, and I just sort of like, I loved Butch Hobson because I liked the Reds. I liked all of you guys. So, that period of time, that thing came on fast. The Red Sox 75 thing. I mean, my cousin might have hung on a little while longer if he knew what you were going to do in 75, right?
Well, here's the story. 73, I was doing a lot of stuff, win a national title for SC and then coming to play pro ball in double A in July. Then won the Little World Series in 73 for AAA. But 74, I got called up in September. Well, Louis was on the team in 74, and we were teammates for a month. And I have to tell you, I was born in Chicago. So when I was a kid, I was raised in Southern California, but would go back to see my relatives. And my aunt on my mom's side, Louise, was her favorite player. See, she used to call him Little Louie. Now, I didn't say, "Hey, nice to meet you, Little Louie." I said, "Mr. Aparicio." But yeah, for a month, we were teammates. And, I was a Giant fan as a kid. So Juan Marichal and Orlando Cepeda were on that 74 team in September. So I'm like a kid in a candy store. You got Luis Aparicio, got Orlando Cepeda, and Juan Marichal. These are my teammates. So I was a pretty happy dude.
All I remember is you guys came into town 74, and I went to my uncle's house, and at the kitchen table in Cockeysville, right up on Padona, above Ordell Bracy's Flaming Pit, Rico Petrocelli, Cepeda, Aparicio, Tiant, arms up in crabs, listening to merengue music, about to play poker all night. Right, you know what I'm saying? Like it
I do.
was literally, you guys were in town, and he had everybody to the house for crabs. So I'm sitting in the house, a little 5-year-old kid, and all these legends are gathered eating crabs because the Red Sox were in town. So, I would think at that point in your life, it all came pretty fast, right? I mean, everybody wants to talk to you about 75, and I'll even say to honor your hat, I met my wife in 2003, and when we got engaged, we had an island wedding. I said to her, "I want you to have a Red Sox hat, and I want it to be the Fred Lynn, that hat, the blue and red, the 75. They don't wear it often. I mean, it feels
No.
throwbackish, but that's the most beautiful hat, and the red brim's also great too. But that 75 thing, people ask you about it all the time, and I always feel bad asking any of the Orioles about 79. The year you don't
Yeah.
win, but the 75 thing. I don't want to say it's been 50 years. It's been 50 years. But I mean, you get asked about
But
50 years, you've been asked about it. It's a wonderful thing for you, even though it didn't end the way you wanted it to end, right?
Yeah, 75 was pretty magical. It kind of reminiscent of this Oriole team that was like last year. A lot of young guys. You look at our starting outfield. You got Jim Rice in left, and me in center, and Dwight Evans in right. We're all 22, 23 years old. Our shortstop, Rick Burleson, is 23 years old. We've got lots of guys under 25 years old on the team. We still have Yaz and Rico from the 67 team, and our pitching staff is veteran. But we had so many young guys that were starters, that nothing, I don't know, nobody really thought we were going to do anything. Nobody predicted or could even think of predicting how well we would play. And I tell people all the time that team is so popular because the fact that our fan base is high school kids and college kids. I don't know how many colleges there are in Boston, but there's a lot. And when June came around and all the kids got out of school, all the bleachers were kids. And they identified with us because we're the same age. Yes, we're the same age. So, and then we played well. We're pretty good. And you can't predict that kind of stuff, right? You just can't. Like you said, it didn't end the way I had hoped that it would. But looking back on it, it was just a magical time. It just doesn't happen. You get Jimmy Rice and I are rookies. And to have two rookies on a pennant contending club hit 3-4 in the lineup and do the things that we were doing, that just doesn't happen. Just doesn't. You might get one, but you don't get two. And then we played side by side. So it was on a lot of different levels. It was so much fun. And back then, I have to tell you that being a rookie was a lot different than it is today's rookies because we didn't have any video. All we did was we talked to our teammates. What's this guy throw? What's this guy going to do? How do you play this guy defensively? I mean, every day was a learning experience for the whole season. And so it went by in a blur because every day is a new day. You could go 3-for-4 one day, and the next day you're facing Jim Palmer. What's he got? Oh, high fastball, big curveball. And so the learning experience was crazy. It was just crazy. But it was so much fun because we're so good.
Could you imagine playing in the modern era with your skill set? I mean, I remember crowding into Jack Murphy Stadium. I got to know Tony Gwynn pretty well during his career. My aunt lived out in San Diego, so I know I know how wonderful San Diego can be in PB and like all that. I've spent in La Jolla the whole deal, but I remember him having the little video. He had a closet, literally with tapes, and he was the only dude doing it. He's the only dude hitting 394 too, at that time. And then in the modern era, remember they had a video department and they would have a few nerds with tapes and whatnot. I'm not, privy to all of that in the modern era since Angelo's owned the team here. But the analytics part of this and coaches and people in the game that I've known of your era that are still in the game, the transition of the game and someone like you that just had an unbelievable natural ability that you own, you probably would have taken to this stuff like a duck to water with the way that you would have made you even a better player, I think. I think it would make you and Rod Carew and people of your era even better if you played in this era to have this sort of information at your disposal.
I believe that a guy like me would use it periodically. I would, I would, if I'm having an issue at the plate, say I'm hitting too many ground balls a second. I know what's happening, but to see it on a video, that would just reconfirm what my mind was telling me I'm doing wrong. And so, that would help a little bit, but I guarantee you, I wouldn't spend too much time there. I don't want to know. Okay, you're in a situation at game time. This guy's got a 2-3, a 2-1 slider. But okay, what if he doesn't? That's why you see today, and I watch some baseball. You see today's game, guys strike out looking a lot because they are convinced the pitcher's going to throw this particular pitch, and they don't. And especially when it's a fastball down the middle, and they take it, you go, what's going on? Well, that's just too much information, too much thinking going on. You can have all that information, but when you get in that box and you're hitting, you just need to focus on what's happening right then, right now. If this guy's dominant with his fastball, that's what you have to look for and adjust to everything else after that. But to be sitting on one pitch can also be dangerous. If I'm facing Randy Johnson from the left side, throwing 100 miles an hour with his fastball and he's got a big sweeper. If I'm looking for that sweeper only and he throws a fastball in and misses, I could be dead. So you literally have to figure out how to protect yourself against that kind of thing, protect your face and your hands, and then still be able to hit that ball away. So you don't want a ton of you want like information, but you have to hone it down. You have to narrow it down when you're in the box because you just have a split second to react. And it's these guys throw as hard as they say they do. That's what you should be looking for.
Fred Lynn is here visiting with us from Southern California for no good reason other than he was a Baltimore Oriole, my favorite player in 1975, and I tracked him down. All right, so a couple things have happened. The internet, obviously. If I would have had you on in 2004, I never it wouldn't have been this good because I found that not just the Aqua Velva commercial,
Oh.
but about 20 minutes before you came on, I got rid of Rick Vaughn, and he's giving me all this Minnesota Frank Viola, Ron Davis, Kurt Wardle was the other one.
Is that what it was? I didn't know the name.
Kurt Wardle was a Saturday night walk-off. I looked out, 49,000 people. Must have been tankard night out at the ballpark. But I found that you were on Fantasy Island, and I know you talked
Awesome.
on opening day up at Fenway with a you can, people can find the video. Give me the long form version. I mean, I told my wife, "Did you know Fred Lynn was on Fantasy Island?" She said, it's a plane," and I'm thinking, there were some benefits to being a good looking ball player, handsome man out in Southern California playing for the Angels. I would think, a lot of the Rams players and Merlin Olsen and Fred Dreyer went into acting or whatnot, but you got a gig. I didn't know it.
Well, here's the story, the backstory to that. Remember the show MASH? Well, Radar was on MASH, Radar O'Reilly, and it was his fantasy to pitch against major leaguers and strike out Steve Garvey, George Brett, and yours truly. So that's how I got on the show. And to be honest with you, it was very comical to watch non-baseball people direct baseball players. I remember they got Steve Garvey hitting, and the cameraman put his camera like at his feet, right in front of the plate. And he says, "Okay, Garvey, I want you to hit one over my head." And I'm going, "What could possibly go wrong here? They think that we can do anything we want with a ball." He could have drilled the guy, but Garvey just hit one over the guy's head. He goes, "Good, that's we'll take it. We'll take that one." I'm going, "Oh my God!" So during the show, they have to make Radar look good on the mound, right? So what they did is they drilled a hole in a baseball and they ran a wire through it, and they connected the wire to the catcher's glove, and then they took a ball on the mound and they threw it. And then they shook the wire, and the ball did a loop-de-loop thing on camera on the show. And it's so very difficult to hit, right? And on the show, you can't see the wire, but it looked really cool when they did it. And the director told me, he says, "Okay, he's going to strike you out on this loop-de-loop pitch. I want you to swing and miss and fall down in a heap." And I said, "I didn't know how to do that. That's not what I do. I had to think about it. So I need to swing and fall down. How's that going to work? Because I've never done that before."
Well, Reggie would always go to the ground, on
Well,
a
you're
swing,
going
right?
one, yeah, on one knee, and then but I'm going to fall down, and look up to the camera, and I kind of did it, sort of, and then my line was, and I thought Nolan Ryan was tough, So it took 2 days to film it. Got to see a lot of my friends, George Brett, and of course it was one of my good friends, and Steve Garvey and Ellis Valentine. Ken Brett was there too, so it was a fun experience. And when I watched the show back, I said, "Wow, it's a lot of work for just that one little shot," but it was fun.
You get your union card?
I did. I have a SAG card.
I was gonna say, you gotta get your SAG card for that. I was
You
gonna
know what?
bring up the union and
I
all
get
that.
royalty. I get royalties from that every once in a while. It's like $2.20.
Well, it is, I talk baseball, modern baseball every day here about all this and Rubinstein buying the Orioles and all that. The labor discord that you had in that era, it's just it really was the war of the worlds for all of you and ownership with Marvin Miller in the middle of it. I mean, really, you were in the middle, Messersmith, that whole era of free agency that you benefited from that, my cousin didn't benefit from, right? I mean, the guys that, of that era, the union's a big part of the baseball story, as I think of it. That's why I brought up the union card. I'm like, yeah, you were a part of a much bigger union.
It was very adversarial, the relationship between players and owners at that point, because in after in 75, the Messersmith McNally, those two guys were going into court, and we knew that they were going to win that case, and free agency was going to happen. And so there were a lot of things going on, and we didn't talk to the owners, they didn't talk to us, they didn't like what was happening, because they had complete control over us for, well, forever. And then they didn't. And so there were lockouts and there were strikes. And it was, my whole career was adversarial with the owners. It just was. And now I'm not quite sure it's quite that way. You know, the money is so much bigger and everybody's making so much money that I think it's abated somewhat. But the guys right before me and my group of guys, you know, we basically paved the way. We took some lumps along the way. And I kind of figured out, I think I lost like almost a half a year of playing time because of lockouts and strikes during the course of my career. So it was tough at sometimes, but, you know, well worth it. You know, and today's players, I hope they appreciate what the guys before them have done.
Well, I think I certainly mean, speaking for my family and my cousin, who didn't make life-altering money ever, you know, made good money by regular standards when you came in at 75. Life-altering money happened right at the beginning of the Reggie, Nolan, Ryan, your period of time, where guys were getting lottery ticket kind of money where it could be really life-altering. Before that, all the money, even for Mickey Mantle, right? And for any of those guys, it was always a fight. And, you know, now it just feels like it rolls off. And having come from your era to come to here to see how much money's involved in it and how much beers are at the ballpark, the sport has come a long way. I just hope they don't shut it down next year because it's so much fun. It's defined your life. It's certainly helped my life to be in Aparicio and to do sports radio for 35 years. It's really, it was fun. It was an honor. I'm going to hit the gavel and say you can be dismissed, but thank you for coming on. And before you go, I want you to talk about your animals and your golf. How's your golf game? Let's start with that because I know that's what you guys do out there in Southern California.
Yeah, you know what? That's one thing that I could still do is play golf. You know, as you get older, you start dropping sports. You know, I played full court basketball till, you know, my late 40s, and I played tennis pretty well till, you know, my 60s, and I had a double knee replacement a couple years ago. And, you know, I can get out there and hit if I want to. But golf is a thing that, you know, we all can still do because of handicaps, and I can move it around for an old guy. You know, so I play pretty well. But as far as charity work goes, my wife and I kind of championed this charity called the Face Foundation in San Diego. And it's a local charity that strictly is for saving animals. You know, when you have euthanasia at your front door and you are a family, say there's a lot of military down here in San Diego and circumstances are beyond your control and it's either, you know, euthanize your animal or you have to give them up or somebody steps in. Well, Face steps in. This organization, if you have say your dog is hit by a car or something like that and you can't pay for it, well, we have a deal with a lot of vets in the San Diego area and we take care of it. And thus far, since we've been involved, my wife and I, probably about 12 years now, I think we saved about 5,000 animals.
That's beautiful, man. If you knew how much I love my cat, you'd know.
Well, yeah, it's a wonderful organization. The benefits of championing this is that it's right now. You know, we're not trying to find a cure for something other than the fact that we're going to save an animal for somebody. And can you imagine two little kids at home and their animals, you know, it's going to be real dicey whether or not you saved this animal. And then that animal comes home. It's like Christmas. So if anybody wants to get involved or take a look at their website, it's face4pets.org.
I'm on it right now. Yeah.
You want to take a look at it and see what we're all about. It's just, and 100% of anything that's donated goes right to the animals. It's just a wonderful organization. And I've seen a lot of charities in my lifetime, but this is the most rewarding for my wife and I.
Boy, they got this beautiful Labrador retriever out in the Pacific Ocean. I hope that, you know, one of the good beaches up there, Solana, one of the, by the belly up. That's where I need to be.
Belly up.
Fred Lynn is here. Fred Lynn's hitting the road. Thank you very much. And I'm glad that you made a little time. And it was always fun to watch you play baseball and to have heroes that 50 years later can come on and talk about good charities and tell some old stories about the old glories of Memorial Stadium. As I drove by there, Memorial Stadium ground is now a Y that serves the community there. It's an incredible, you know, community thing. And obviously Camden Yards been a win. So the baseball legacy of everything here in Baltimore is just a beautiful thing all these years later, Fred.
I'm going to say one more shout out to 33rd Street. You know, that's where Memorial Stadium was. And yeah, it was for the Baltimore Colts, you know, and they played baseball too. And that's when the Baltimore Colts left town at midnight. Remember that?
I do remember that.
I was a big Colts fan. I was a Johnny Unitas guy, number 19, right? So I was a big Colts fan, and it was, and, you know, hated to see that happen. But to reiterate, I just loved my time there. I really did. My wife, Natalie, and I, we made a lot of friends, and we had nothing but fond memories about Baltimore.
Did you wear 19 because of Johnny Unitas, or are you making that up?
No, I made number 19, and we just that was coincidence. I was number 8 in college. So when I got to the big leagues, well, some guy named Stremski had 8. I didn't think he was going to give it up. So I said, well, let's see, how can it work this out? 19, see, 1 from 9 is 8. So 19.
That's it. All right. It's a math equation. That's fine. All right. Good, good, good. Fred, thank you very much. Fred Lynn's out in Southern California. Help him by helping face4pets.org. I love when everybody has a cause out there. We should all have a cause as beautiful as this golden retriever out in the surf. Makes me want to get out to San Diego and see some baseball at some point. I am Nestor. We are WNST, AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore. And if we're going to be last place all summer, I'm going to go find some cool baseball people to talk to. So stick around.